headlines, the United Nations warns that Afghanistan's humanitarian needs are catastrophic or at large scale and are increasing. More U.S. senators call on President Joe Biden to step down in the wake of Kabul airport attacks that left 13 American soldiers dead. India reports nearly 45,000 new daily COVID-19 cases and almost 500 more deaths. Hello and welcome, everybody. The United Nations has appealed for humanitarian aid for Afghanistan, describing the situation in that country as catastrophic. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said the humanitarian needs are large-scale and are increasing. It added that people are suffering from decades of conflict compounded by drought and COVID-19. The UN has appealed for $1.3 billion in aid to help some 16 million people in Afghanistan this year. But an $800 million gap remains. The world body has also warned that low supplies of food aid could plunge war-ravaged Afghanistan into humanitarian disaster once winter arrives. A host of Republican U.S. legislators have called on President Joe Biden to step down. The demand surged in the hours after the deadly bombings in Kabul. Those demanding Biden's resignation include Senator Josh Hawley. He said the president has now overseen the deadliest day for U.S. troops in Afghanistan in over a decade. Hawley added that the crisis is growing by the hour and blamed it on what he called Biden's catastrophic failure of leadership. Senator Marsha Blackburn also called for the resignation of Biden Vice President Kamala Harris and several other members of the administration. The senator said they should all resign or face impeachment and removal from office. Well, the Pentagon has warned of more attacks in the Afghan capital after two bomb blasts there killed 13 American troops. A Thursday attack outside Kabul airport injured 18 U.S. troops as well. It was claimed by the Daesh terror group and also left 72 Afghans dead, including civilians. Scores of others were also injured.
Suicide bombers set off two blasts in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, on Thursday. The bombings took place outside Hamid Karzai International Airport as thousands were awaiting evacuations following a Taliban takeover of Kabul. Casualties included Afghan civilians and American forces. The U.S. troops suffered their heaviest casualty toll in a single incident in Afghanistan since 2011. In response, President Joe Biden promised punishment for the perpetrators. Biden, under enormous pressure over his administration's handling of the Afghan crisis, said the airlift would continue.
We will not forgive. We will not forget. We will hunt you down and make you pay. We will not be deterred by terrorists. We will not let them stop our mission. We will continue the evacuation.
More than 100,000 people have been flown out of Afghanistan since the Taliban swept into power on August 15th. The Taliban had allowed the U.S.-led forces to conduct the airlift while planning to finalize their own government as soon as the American troops left. U.S. forces are racing to complete their withdrawal from Afghanistan by an August 31 deadline set by President Biden. His administration is facing growing criticism over the situation in Afghanistan and what is seen as a hasty withdrawal after two decades of military presence. Biden, however, says the U.S. has long ago achieved its original rationale for invading Afghanistan in 2001, to root out al-Qaeda militants and prevent a repeat of the September 11 attacks on the United States. Analysts believe the U.S. has failed to achieve any of its objectives.
Despite spending $200 million per day over the past 20 years, accumulating well in excess of some $2, $3 trillion of U.S. taxpayer money, despite sending hundreds of thousands of U.S. troops, our youth, our sisters and brothers who are now traumatized, some lost life and limb, U.S. imperialism has very clearly lost. They've been kicked out by an indigenous resistance.
the U.S. invaded Afghanistan with the stated goal of toppling the Taliban and improving security there. 20 years on, nothing has changed on the ground except the death of tens of thousands of innocent civilians. That, along with the current chaotic pullout, has more than ever raised questions on Washington's real intention about this Afghanistan operation.
Well, the evacuation of foreign nationals and military forces from Afghanistan is underway nearly 2 weeks after the Taliban seized power there. Spain, Sweden, and Switzerland say they've concluded their evacuation operations out of the Afghan capital. Britain also says its forces have entered the final stages of evacuating people from Kabul. London has warned that the threat from further attacks at Kabul airport would grow as evacuation goes on. Meanwhile, the U.S. is going ahead with its own withdrawal operation as well. Washington says more than 82,000 people have left Kabul, while at least 1,500 American citizens remain. The U.S. should end its withdrawal process by the end of this month. Political commentator John White believes that Americans did not bring democracy or security to Afghanistan, and rather the cause of instability and chaos in that country.
Well, this is one of the most abject military and political humiliations suffered by an empire going back to the days of Alexander the Great when it comes to engagement with Afghanistan. This is not a withdrawal from Afghanistan by the Biden administration. It's a scramble. It's a mad scramble. And he has created a security vacuum. The previous Afghan administration has collapsed like a house of cards. The Taliban has yet to set up its government. And so these are the fortuitous circumstances and conditions for terror attacks to be carried out by groups such as ISIS or ISIS-K, as the case may be, in regards to Afghanistan. This is on Joe Biden. He has turned thousands of people at Kabul airport into sitting ducks. There will likely be more terror attacks before the US ends its evacuation mission, which is scheduled for August the 31st, next Tuesday. It's a failed crusade. It's a fool's crusade. Trillions and trillions of dollars expended over 20 years, thousands and thousands of people killed, slaughtered, maimed, the vast majority Afghan civilians, for the objective of replacing the Taliban with the Taliban. It's a humiliating day for US imperialism, and it's a sad day for Afghan society, and it just goes, you cannot ever take the word of American generals or an American president when it comes to occupying your country and bring in all the supposed benefits of Western liberal democracy. The Americans brought democracy, they did not bring security, and indeed they've only wrought and sown instability in that country.
Iran's foreign minister says his country is committed to constructive dialogue and interaction within the framework of diplomacy. Hossein Amir Abdullahian made the remarks in a phone call with the EU foreign policy chief, that after Josep Borrell said Brussels is waiting for Tehran to announce a date for the next meeting on the revival of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Abdullahian stressed that the negotiations should have tangible results and ensure the rights and interests of the Iranian nation. Tehran and the remaining signatories to the deal have held several rounds of talks in Vienna, but have not reached any conclusion amid continued U.S. sanctions on Iran. The U.S. withdrew from the accord in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. After taking office, President Joe Biden has failed to remove unilateral sanctions imposed by his predecessor. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says dozens of Palestinians have been injured after Israeli forces attacked anti-settlement protesters near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. Health officials say two of the injured are in critical condition. The clashes erupted in the town of Beita near Nablus, where people were protesting against the regime's land grab policy. The Palestinian town has been the scene of protests for weeks over the regime's settlement activities, as well as its planned eviction of Palestinian families from their ancestral homes. All Israeli settlements are illegal under international law. The regime, backed by the U.S., has embarked on settlement activities in defiance of several U.N. Security Council resolutions. Vietnam's COVID-19 death toll surpasses the 10,000 mark after the country logged a new daily record of 356 fatalities. Health authorities also reported an all-time high of nearly 13,000 new infections. Vietnam's overall caseload stands at over 410,000. The city of Ho Chi Minh is the worst hit, where authorities have issued stay-at-home orders to slow the spread of the coronavirus. Elsewhere, the Indian government has asked authorities in the states of Kerala and Maharashtra to consider imposing night curfews. That after the country reported nearly 45,000 new cases and almost 500 deaths on Friday, with over 32.6 million infections. India has recorded the largest number of cases after the United States. And Iran has reported 571 new COVID-19 fatalities, raising its death toll from the pandemic to over 105,000. The health ministry also confirmed more than 36,000 new infections for the past day. The country's overall caseload now stands at nearly 4.87 million. Almost 4,000 COVID patients are currently in intensive care units. Iran has been in the grip of the fifth wave of the pandemic since late June, despite restrictions to curb the outbreak. Nearly 360 cities are now designated as red, the highest category on Iran's coronavirus risk scale. Over 17.8 million people have received the first dose of a COVID vaccine nationwide. More than 7.2 million have so far been fully inoculated. Representative of the World Health Organization to Tehran says Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccine has been delayed for different reasons. Salman Kudri reports on that.
Representative of the World Health Organization to the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Jafar Hussain, has visited one of the main vaccination centers in capital Tehran to closely monitor the process of vaccination. In a country where the Delta variant of the coronavirus is killing almost 700 people on a daily basis. During his visit, he learned about different phases of the process, both before and after the vaccination. The WHO representative said that despite sanctions and economic problems, Iran is among countries which has already paid for vaccines from COVAX, but the delivery of the vaccines has been delayed for different reasons.
Iran is a country which has paid already for 16.8 million doses from COVAX, already paid with all the economic sanctions, everything it is facing. The problem is that because of the major outbreaks in other part of the world, like India, like Brazil and other, the vaccine availability globally reduced. What our Director General is recommending to every country head of the state, that it is a whole of society, whole of government approach to control COVID. Not only government can do it, not only WHO can do it, not only other UN, not only private, everybody has to join hand.
The number of outpatients with COVID-19 has decreased by almost 2% this week. We anticipate that the number of hospitalizations will even come down next week.
Iran's death toll from COVID-19 has exceeded 100,000. The rapid rise in COVID-19 cases and deaths in the past weeks has prompted Iranian officials to make utmost efforts to import more vaccines and accelerate the vaccination pace.
According to official reports, almost 10% of the Iranian population have already received two jabs of the COVID-19 vaccines. Experts say the pace is too slow. Accordingly, the new Iranian government has vowed to take all necessary measures to accelerate the vaccination pace and manage the pandemic as soon as possible. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Brazil has registered over 31,000 new coronavirus infections and 920 daily deaths. The figure put the South American country's total confirmed cases at over 20.6 million and its deaths at over 577,000. Brazil is the world's third worst hit nation in terms of coronavirus infections. It's also witnessed the world's second deadliest outbreak after the United States. Meanwhile, Mexico has posted more than 26,000 new daily cases and 835 fatalities. Mexican authorities say the actual figures are probably much higher than the official data. The Italian government's plan to extend COVID green pass requirement to all key workers and state employees is causing a stir. Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID green pass. Max Giovanni reports from Rome.
The Italian government is considering further expanding its green pass scheme, which is part of a plan that aims to have 80% of its citizens vaccinated against the pandemic by the end of September. Despite a significant recent slowdown in the vaccination rate, about 60% of the population has received both doses of COVID-19 vaccine in Italy so far. The government is now considering making it a requirement for employees to show proof of vaccination, testing or recovery at workplaces, including public offices and supermarkets.
La Sicilia Mind you, the Sicily region, which has the lowest number of vaccinated people, could soon be classified as a high-risk red zone. The vast majority of those in intensive care units these days have not been vaccinated, and the Green Pass scheme serves the purpose of changing their mind.
Italy's Prime Minister Mario Draghi has repeatedly said that the use of the Green Pass scheme is the only alternative to a new lockdown. However, a conspicuous number of Italians are opposing the government's anti-COVID rules that they say infringe on their civil liberties.
Many in Italy are not willing to get vaccinated and are against the mandatory anti-COVID Green Pass. Earlier this month, protests were held in several Italian cities against the introduction of new measures requiring proof of vaccination.
L'essere umano è così, non siamo mai tutti
d'accordo. That's how people are made. We cannot agree on everything, but the vaccine and the Green Pass is the way to go.
Basta queste scuse.
Enough with excuses. We are not kids. Maybe our authorities should be more severe with those who refuse to get vaccinated.
Since August 6, the Green Pass has been required in order to enter cultural and leisure venues across Italy. From September the 1st, the pass will also be a requirement for all teachers and other school staff. However, the National Association of Head Teachers warned on Wednesday that schools are not equipped to check all the students' vaccine passports. Max Civili, Rome.
That's a wrap for now. Bye for now, everybody.
Join us in this journey, IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new report published by Oil Change International and other organizations entitled unused tools, how central banks are fueling the climate crisis, reveals that 12 of the largest central banks around the globe continue to support climate chaos-causing fossil fuels through policy and direct finance. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Andy Rowell Ryder. This article is published under the heading, Dirty Dozen Central Banks Are Still Fueling Climate Chaos as World Burns. Stay tuned for more. Recently, UNICEF reported how 1 billion children are already at extremely high risk from the effects of rapidly changing climate, such as heat waves, floods, cyclones, disease, and drought. Responding to this stark figure, climate activist Greta Thunberg stated that the world is still not treating the climate crisis like an emergency. We are still just talking and greenwashing things instead of taking real action. Central banks could play a critical role in catalyzing the rapid shift of financial flows away from oil, fossil fuel, and coal, and toward the zero-carbon solutions required to confront the climate crisis. It is easy to see why a generation of young activists is still so angry with the elder generation. So much of the climate debate boils down to finance. It is a simple ask. Stop funding climate chaos and invest in clean, renewable energy. Organization after organization is now calling for an end to exploration and production of fossil fuels. And that means stopping the finance of new fossil fuel projects. The world's energy watchdog, the International Energy Agency, IEA, long seen a laggard on this issue, has now acknowledged that to limit warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius and avoid the worst of the climate crisis, we must cease all new investments in the expansion of oil, gas, and coal supply beyond that already committed now. The world's leading scientists, the IPCC, have also recently issued a code red for humanity and said, we must stop investing in fossil fuels. But despite these warnings and continued record floods and wildfires around the globe, and now the new report from UNICEF, this is still not happening. Especially with key players in climate crisis, central banks. Central banks could play a critical role in catalyzing the rapid shift of financial flows away from oil, fossil gas, and coal, and toward the zero-carbon solutions required to confront the climate crisis. To date, however, this is not happening. A new report published by Oil Change International and other organizations entitled Unused Tools, How Central Banks Are Fueling the Climate Crisis, reveals that 12 of the largest central banks around the globe to continue to support climate chaos-causing fossil fuels through policy and direct finance. Using a 10-point system to gauge how well central banks were responding to the climate crisis, the new analysis finds that not one of the 12 major central banks analyzed comes close to alignment with the Paris Agreement on any of the criteria, not one bank. The criteria focused on three aspects of central banks' functions, including asset management, rules and support for commercial banks, and policy research, so including both monetary policy and prudential regulation. And the report found that between 2016 and 2020, central banks failed to prevent financial flows to fossil fuels on the order of $3.8 trillion. financial flows to exploration and development projects, which will allow fossil fuel production to grow in the future, as well as to other aspects of fossil fuel producers' businesses, have continued to increase. To stop this, the report provides a series of recommendations to better align central banks' activities with climate goals, including amending the mandates of central banks where necessary to give them the power to support the managed decline of fossil fuel production by facilitating an end to fossil fuel finance in line with the Paris Agreement. The time to act is now. Central banks have access to powerful tools to confront the climate crisis, but they aren't using them. Instead of using their power to cut off finance for fossil fuels, they are making themselves busy tinkering around the edges of the climate crisis, said David Tong, Global Industry Campaign Manager at Oil Change International and an author of the report, adding, "The climate crisis is too dire and too urgent for such critical institutions to be dawdling when they could be leading the finance sector in a new climate safe direction." Danisha Kazi, senior economist at UK organization Positive Money, said, "There is a growing consensus among civil society that the world's major central banks are failing to play their part in tackling the climate crisis. By propelling finance towards environmental destruction, they are placing both financial and planetary stability at risk." Kazi continued, "While central banks continue to shy away from their duty to the public, the most vulnerable, particularly communities in the global south, will continue to bear the ever-intensifying brunt of their inaction." Kazi's comments dovetail with those of UNICEF's executive director, Henrietta Fore, who said recently, "Climate change is deeply inequitable. While no child is responsible for rising global temperatures, they will pay the highest cost. The children from countries least responsible will suffer most of all. It is time the central bankers stop failing the next generation."
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
We get people. Housing crisis in America.
The U.S. is facing a decade-long housing shortage. The government will have to build homes for dozens of years to tackle this issue. Home prices in almost every U.S. state have been on the rise over the past year with no end in sight.
Currently in the United States, we have a huge shortage of housing. We're not producing nearly as much housing as we should be.
We know that home ownership is the primary way of getting into the middle class, but unfortunately, there are many impediments to that that are divided by class and particularly race.
Hello and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Daniel Arya. Now, as the Delta variant of the coronavirus spreads fast across America, people are still suffering to meet the basic needs of their families, including a place to stay. Tenants are naturally the most vulnerable in dealing with evictions. In this episode, we will delve into the housing crisis in America and how more painful it's become throughout this pandemic. stay with us.
If you're looking to buy a home, the best thing you can do from a flood perspective is know what your current risk is from the current environment, and then how that will evolve over the next 30 years. And flood risk isn't a static, one-time thing that you need to look at. It is an ever-evolving risk that continues to grow in some parts of the country at an exponential rate.
The economic fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic has hit America hard, with many people losing their jobs, particularly in the fast food industry, airlines, hotels, restaurants, and the service sector. Low-income families are struggling to make ends meet. Affordable housing is a key issue. The plight of tenants has escalated into a legal and political row about evictions.
You know, there are so many rental property owners, housing providers, who are independent rental owners. They're not large corporations. And when they don't receive rent, they still have to find a way to pay their mortgage for the property, to pay the water, the lights, to pay the insurance. There's been no relief for them on that particular front. And I can tell you some of our own stories. And in my company in Southern California, we do manage for independent rental owners. I have one client who owns 5 rental units. She has one renter who hasn't paid rent since April of last year and is now delinquent to the tune of $21,000.
The idea was that landlords are not allowed to evict their tenants throughout this pandemic, which has caused serious economic hurdles for many inside the United States. Our first guest today is economist Marcia Baker. Welcome to the show, madam. First off, what challenges is the nation facing today which emanate from the overarching issue of housing in America?
Americans have a housing challenge alongside a challenge of unreliable electricity, a very difficult transportation, food access, healthcare access, and with housing, there are 580,000 homeless by official count. And beyond that, the U.S. has the highest rate ever in the number of people per household. The old are staying with their younger children. You have 3 and 4 generations crammed together. So you have a crisis of living conditions and people being very upset and worried because they're one day from being out on the street. So the drug addiction problem, alcoholism problem, it all goes together in the housing crisis in the U.S. today.
Facing a deadly global pandemic, low-income families are finding it increasingly difficult to make ends meet. Struggling tenants are facing the threat of eviction from their landlords. Meanwhile, home builders and apartment associations have spent millions of dollars on lobbying for an end to the moratorium on rental evictions. As the ban expired on 31st of July, President Joe Biden reportedly froze housing lobbyists out of discussions with the White House, and he asked the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, to issue a renewed ban on evictions of tenants. The 60-day ban was duly issued.
Are you sure it's going to pass Supreme Court muster?
There are several key scholars who think that it may, and it's worth the effort.
His argument is that even if this move is ultimately blocked by the courts, at the very least, it will buy states time to distribute tens of billions of dollars in federal rent forgiveness to help make renters whole and keep them from being kicked out of their homes.
Yet, the fight over whether landlords should be allowed to evict their cash-strapped tenants has to be resolved in American courts. We're now joined by journalist Mike Harris for his insight into the matter.
Well, my pleasure.
Now, Mike, how come housing is still a problem in America today, considering the fact that the U.S. is spending huge amounts of money elsewhere in the world for military and intelligence purposes?
Well, one fundamental truth that the government of the United States has forgotten is that they are here to serve the people. And that truth has been lost. They're currently more involved with serving the special interest groups, namely the military-industrial complex, the big banking cartels, those people who are trying to consolidate and expand the U.S. empire. In fact, our government has in many cases turned toxic against the people of the United States and is doing things that are really prosecuting the U.S., the citizens of the U.S. and damaging them in many ways.
A CDC ban on evictions by landlords was introduced specifically to address the situation in counties with high levels of COVID-19 transmission. But the ban soon turned into a subject for political wrangling among politicians, and landlords soon rushed to put an end to it through legal lobbying.
What I also understand is what it's like to get an eviction notice.
Years ago, she lived out of her car while caring for a newborn and a toddler.
I know what it's like every single minute to not be able to sleep because you got two kids, you got to make sure that you keep safe.
It will be a win for people who have, for such a long time, because I'm one of those people, that's why I ran for office, felt like nobody listened.
The CDC measure was supposedly meant to protect tenants who state under a penalty of perjury that they are unable to pay rent and would face overcrowded conditions if evicted. The measure in part triggered a fierce debate about the federal government's authority to do so. What is the situation like today, and what should be done about it?
The immediate situation in August in the United States regarding housing is there is an extension of preventing throwing people out of their houses until October. The institutions of the United States, the courts, the Supreme Court, the presidency, has approved this, and this is a continuation of not evicting people that came in under President Trump during the pandemic in 2020. But there's no solution here. What is necessary is to freeze the rental agreements and the mortgage mortgage contracts and sort them all out.
The House Democrats initially rushed to reverse course amid a serious divide between progressive lawmakers and the housing lobbyists. But after a short time, some Democrats fell in line with the lobbyists, putting the fate of evictions hanging in the balance. As the power struggle continues, nearly 45 million tenants in the United States are facing growing concerns about how to resist evictions by their landlords.
$50 billion was allocated, $46 billion. Less than 10% of that has been spent. Around $3 billion is reported to me, but let's say it would be 10%. Why should the renters be punished for the fact that the system did not put money in their pockets to pay the rent to the landlords? So that's where we come to this. It's like, well, CDC, you have defined this, and these people have not gotten the money. So this is, I think this is something that will work out. It isn't about any more money. The money is there, resting in localities and governor's offices across the country.
There are also more than 500,000 homeless people today, according to official estimates, who see no path to the right to have a home. The power play in Washington is indeed causing a great amount of human suffering as politicians continue partisanship in the hopes of gaining more control. So what role do you think that partisanship plays in the housing shortage and homelessness in America today?
The problem in America regarding leadership is we have conflicts between parties when above the parties, we have to have the right policies. And you have Wall Street and London heavily represented in both parties that want to continue to have a bailout, want to speculate in housing, speculate in unregulated electricity, and worse, they want crazy green policies. So the solution to the housing and the rest of the lack of production in the United States that's currently the condition is above parties.
For decades, powerful housing industry groups have been lobbying politicians on Capitol Hill to influence policy. Take the most powerful one, the 100-year-old National Association of Realtors, or NAR, which has spent nearly $700 million on lobbying politicians since 1998.
Hi, I'm Charlie Lee, Senior Counsel and Director of Legal Affairs at NAR. As buyers compete in a hot real estate market, they are searching for ways to stand out from the crowd. One method being used is to send a love letter to entice the seller into choosing their offer. While a love letter may seem innocent, they can raise fair housing concerns and risk exposing both the real estate broker and their clients to legal risks.
It is no surprise that since the pandemic began, the association has been at the forefront of the legal fight to end the moratorium on rental evictions. But the association is not alone and has the backing of the U.S. Supreme Court, which bolstered the legal case against the ban by giving the Biden administration just 3 days to end prohibition of evictions. The ban on evictions had been initially imposed by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention last September.
The big firms like Vanguard and State Street and BlackRock have been buying real estate, residential real estate, at a prodigious rate and have been bidding up the prices. Well, they're going to crash those prices in conjunction with the eviction moratorium expiring. And so what this is going to do is going to have a catastrophic effect on all of real estate pricing. So real estate pricing in the U.S. is going to be cut 40, 50, 60, 70% in its current valuation. What this is going to do is the same situation they were in back in 2006, 7, and 8 when the mortgage crisis happened, and people could not refinance. They could not sell their homes for what they owed on them, and they were forced into foreclosure again.
The totality of the row over evictions sheds light on the depth of divide within the U.S. political system, with the Supreme Court, the Biden administration, and the CDC fighting to take the right decision. The American people appear to be the actual victims of inaction by U.S. authorities. American officials have indeed failed to ease circumstances for many.
You know, the lawsuit that the Southern California Rental Housing Association has filed in federal court has been denied, and we immediately filed an appeal. One might wonder why we would file an appeal on some legislation that's due to expire, quite frankly, today. But what we're seeing is this overabundance of legislation against rental housing providers and this pitting of renters versus rental housing providers. And we want it to stop.
Now, Americans have until October 3rd for the latest CDC moratorium to expire. The buildup of tensions among the poor is getting out of control, whereas realtor lobbyists brutally advance their agenda to give more power to landlords, who are the people promoting the idea of a return to evictions. How are they benefiting from evictions, and what is their ultimate goal?
The people who are promoting this are the banking cartel, run by the five or six too-big-to-fail banks that were bailed out by the taxpayers in 2008. It's the same people. They're the ones who underwrite the loans. Those are the ones who make it possible. They're the ones who are going to benefit by taking possession of the wealth and property of the middle class. And what they're going to do is turn America from a home-owning society into a rental society, where the American dream of owning your own home will be gone. And they're doing this. This is part of their goal to asset strip. They're strip mining the American middle class and trying to steal all their wealth to remove what little wealth that the people of the United States currently enjoy.
Housing went on a historic run this year, despite the common assumption that it would sink in the wake of the economic recession caused by the coronavirus pandemic. But the housing market is seeing a major shift. As fewer properties are available in the market, the situation is triggering bidding wars across the country, and house prices are rising steadily.
There's a bidding war for literally every home on the market, every fixer-upper, every house that needs even a lot of work.
My neighbors, actually, because we're on vacation, were calling me and texting me saying, what is going on at your house? There's people in a line down the block. We saw two people having a fight.
Everybody expected housing to really sort of dry up.
The situation is convincing a significant portion of the population to immigrate, and one top destination would be across the Atlantic to Europe, according to statistics. Would-be home buyers are getting fed up by soaring prices, and they're lost out in bidding wars.
The underlying problem in the United States with housing, and the same with other physical and soft infrastructure like schools or manufacturing plants, is the physical production of housing and of manufacturing is it has not been expanding. You have not had the housing units built that you need. And worse than that, you've had decades of speculation in pre-existing housing, and you have the Wall Street London factor coming in on this situation, making big profiteering off big mansions, while the ordinary worker families of the nation do not have adequate housing.
With prospects of owning a home becoming increasingly distant for many Americans, people are wondering where the housing market is headed to next. Many experts believe that house prices will continue to rise, and there is virtually no prospect of a significant fall in house prices in the near future. Meanwhile, homes are selling for up to 30% over asking price. Nationwide, houses are being sold for more than their original list price.
We know that that typically also requires having a certain amount of income. And for a lot of people, that is much easier said than done. For example, for people of color, it is much harder to be able to put down that type of down payment because they may not have the familial support as people who come from more affluent neighborhoods.
These gaps are exceedingly troubling because the implications of them are very pervasive. Black household wealth is one-tenth what it is for white households, and a big, large portion of that gap is due to the lack of home ownership. Even though mortgage rates are at historic lows, there's been a ratcheting up of the qualifications that are required to borrow to become a homeowner, and that has impacted minority households more than majority households.
Of course, there is plenty of space and materials for building new homes. However, greater supply of new houses does not solve the problems of housing and homelessness in America, since these new homes remain unaffordable and out of reach for many.
You have to remember that 2006, 7, 8, when the Wall Street banking firms inflated the real estate bubble and intentionally burst it and dispossessed over 8 million households. And so that recovery has kind of happened. The people who were dispossessed still have not recovered fully. And so one of the reasons that we have such a homeless problem is because of that, because people lost everything. So you have a middle class that is struggling to hang on to what little it has left. And now we have our current crisis, this COVID issue.
The housing crisis, of course, was not caused by the pandemic, but only exacerbated by it. Back in 2018, the official statistics of the federal government showed some 35% of the people could be unsheltered across the states. People had no idea a global pandemic was about to break out.
The codes basically say if you have this kind of function going on within a building, in this kind of building, you can use these standards in order to meet our level of safety, sanitation, etc.
When you build in an area, one of the first things you do is you acquaint yourself with the exact code requirements that will affect the development and building process at that specific site. Then the specifics you also check against the code as you go.
Though we at FEMA are active in that process and engage in promoting these hazard-resistant building and fire codes, it is really down to the local level to adopt and implement those new codes and standards.
The insufficient construction of new housing units is indeed a deep-rooted issue in a country tagged developed. Now that is a serious challenge facing the Biden administration, which is expected to focus on the construction of affordable housing. Some also argue that there should be higher taxes on returns from real estate investments.
There is a range of people and firms that want to end the ban on evictions, and they range from a grandmother who lives on renting out half of her house to big institutions that are profiteering, pirate investment firms like BlackRock that set up a company to buy mass housing, or Warren Buffett. They have their interest in lifting the ban on evictions, plus many realtor associations. But you can't take one side. You have to get rid of this speculative side of this. We should not have speculation in a necessity of life, which is housing.
A persistent problem the Biden administration must address is housing discrimination. Housing discrimination originates from discriminatory regulations deeply embedded within the U.S. law. For example, the practice of redlining black neighborhoods, denying African Americans credit to buy homes, has left deep scars in communities up and down the United States. Black Americans are still regularly and disproportionately targeted by predatory lenders and locked out of neighborhood opportunities. As a nation, America has not invested enough political will or dollars to bring about an equitable and affordable housing market for all of its population. The Biden administration has voiced its desire to increase the supply of affordable housing through tax credits. Yet, it remains far from clear whether this strategy will be effective in either the short term or the long term.
When you look at inequality in the United States of America, you have to start with housing. Where you put your head at night determines so many things about your life. It determines where your kids go to school. It determines the air you breathe, where you shop, how long it takes you to get to work. What we've seen in California is, as a result of policy, we have millions too few housing units. And that affects everybody in California. It starts with a homeless crisis that goes all through the state, but it also includes skyrocketing rents that affect every single working person in the state of California.
Now, having a shelter is, of course, not a privilege, but a right for every living individual. Apart from the housing crisis at a higher level, there are approximately 17 people experiencing homelessness per every 10,000 people in the general population with no hope of achieving the right to have a home. Well, that was our show, everyone. Thank you for joining us. Please tune in next week when we come back together for another episode of We the People. I'm your host, Daniel Arya, and goodbye for now.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.